Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art Beats and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to help you plan that unbelievable travel experience. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hello, this is Good One, a podcast about jokes. I'm your host, Vulture Senior Editor, Jesse David Fox. Each episode, I have a comedian come on to play a clip of one of their bits and then discuss how they wrote it and how it fits into what they're trying to do with their comedy. This week, we have a very special, very surreal episode on multiple levels, as our guest is Mark Maron. First, on a personal level, this show, Good One, would not exist without Mark launching his podcast WTF 11 years ago. Beyond what he did for podcasting in general, bringing a lot of attention and legitimacy to the medium, WTF undeniably changed his country's relationship to comedy. Mark took comedy and comedians seriously and in turn helped an audience, meaning the generic comedy audience, learn to value these artists and their art form differently. I was not a full-time journalist when the show launched, but when it did and I was listening from the beginning, I saw a space that I wanted to be in, that I thought I could be comfortable in. My career, this podcast, would not exist otherwise. That's reason one. The second reason should not be a surprise, since you are all living in it as well. I recorded this interview with Mark while much of the country was finally coming to terms with the severity of coronavirus. On the episode, we discussed the opening table-setting joke from his new Netflix special, End Times Fun, which is his fourth hour-long special after 2013's Thinky Pain, 2015's More Later, and 2017's Too Real. That's on top of a bunch of albums and half hours over the course of his 35-year career. But End Times Fun has proven to be bizarrely, morosely timely as it deals with themes of uncertainty and fear and isolation in the face of a looming apocalypse. I know. It actually builds this something to behold closer that is hard to describe. It's dark and offensive. It's silly and grotesque, cynical and spiritual. As Mark mentions in this interview, he wrote this special hoping to pay tribute to all of his comedy heroes, from obvious legends like Richard Pryor, George Carlin, and Bill Hicks, to the more unexpected like old vaudeville acts. And he also wanted to celebrate all he's done as a comedian to grow into the stand-up he is today. If you haven't watched the special, I highly recommend it. It's cathartic, and despite Mark's aggressively neurotic or neurotically aggressive tone, it's sort of calming. It will make you feel a little worse, but a lot better. To that point, I'm recording this from the microphone Vox has kindly sent to my apartment. Good One will go on. We have a few interviews banked and plans on how to record new ones. I think if there is one thing Mark and I have in common, it's that comedy has always been there for us, bringing us great solace in darker times. Comedy is a great communal relief, so I hope, even in these uncertain times, you can least depend on us. May I suggest putting on an episode and going for a little walk? That would be nice. So here is the joke from End Times Fun and my interview with Mark Maron.
I just don't know. I don't know anymore. It's my job to think of funny things, to sit around and think of funny things. And a few weeks ago, I was sitting on my couch and I realized, like, I just don't know. And then it went from there to like, what do I know actually? What do I, and then it went from there to like, do I really know anything? Like, how much do I really know? And you got to be careful with this type of rabbit hole within your own brain, because it can go quickly to like, do I even exist? Which is sort of sophomoric. But usually at that moment, I always look at my cat Monkey and I go, well, Monkey's there and he's looking at me, so I'm here. So Monkey's always the philosophy killer. I can always rely on him for that. But if you really think about what you really actually know, it's only a few things, like seven things maybe everybody knows. The rest is just patterns you call a life. And but like, if you actually made a column of things you're pretty sure you know for sure, and then made another column of how you know those things, most of that column is like, no, some guy told me. You know, it's not sourced material. It's just, it's clickbait and hearsay. That's all. Goes into the head, locks onto a feeling. You're like, that sounds good. I'm going to tell other people that. And that's how brand marketing works, and also fascism, we're finding. So what is the point? The point is, like somebody, like, I don't know. Look, I take vitamins, all right? I take them. I take them every day. I take vitamin B, vitamin C, vitamin D. And every day they're in my hand, I look at them, and in my heart, I think, these don't fucking do anything. There's no way they do anything. I know they don't do anything, but other part of me believes that they do. You can actually believe something that you know is bullshit. It's a problem. So now, man, I take them every day because, you know, I'm afraid to die, and I think it's going to give me a leg up. That's why everybody takes them, right? It's gotten to the point where if I don't take them, I've actually driven back to my house to take vitamins I know don't fucking do anything, because I believe that might be the day I get whatever it's going to be that I get. Do you understand? All right. I think the deeper point here is, you never know when someone's going to dump some shit into your head that's going to ruin your life, or at least change it for months, or just cause you trouble. And it could be just in passing, somebody just drops shit into your head and you have to deal with it. Like, you could just be having a day and somebody maybe you know or don't know that well goes, you taking turmeric? What? Turmeric, are you taking it? Turmeric? Yeah, you got to take that shit. Turmeric. Yup. The spice? Yeah. You got to take it. Turmeric, the spice. Yeah, man, you got to take that. The spice that you buy once to make an Indian recipe and you never use it again and it stains your wooden spoon, that turmeric? Yeah, you got to take that shit. I do? Yup, for what? Inflammation. Of what? Just general inflammation. What is that? It's the new bad thing that causes all the other bad things. What happened to cholesterol? Turns out that's good for you. What? When did that happen? Turmeric, huh? Who told you about this? My trainer? All right, so the guy who wanted to do something else with his life saw something online, told you, and now you're dumping it into my head. Now I got to worry about whether I'm going to take turmeric or not. And I apologize. I know it's a little condescending to trainers, and some people get a little weird about that. I don't know why. Is that a surprise? Most trainers wasn't their life goal, all right? They had other plans. The team didn't work out. They didn't make the team. They were at the gym a lot anyways. Whatever. Just wasn't the big plan for them, all right? They ended up there. And they can take this criticism. It's just, I'm just calling a fact a fact. I'm not going to make fun of yoga instructors, because that's different. That's sort of the last stop for them. You know, you want to be nice to them. You don't know how they got there. It's probably a harrowing tale. But, you know, you're kind of grateful they made it to wherever they are. And you know that you being in their class is as important to them as they are to you. Like, if it doesn't work out for the trainer, I'm sure he's going to figure out something else to do. The yoga instructor, we really don't know where that goes. You know, back to the turmeric guy. As he's walking away, he's like, oh, yeah, if you're going to get the turmeric, make sure you get it with black pepper in it or it won't activate. Now, right there, doesn't that make you go like, that sounds like bullshit to me a little bit? Am I that big of a sucker that you think I would believe that? Where's the science on that? That sounds like a couple of vitamin hustlers sitting over a mound of wholesale turmeric with a bunch of empty gel caps. One guy going, I don't know, man. I don't think we can move this just like this. It's just a spice. I think we got to add something. Yeah, like what, boss? I don't know why it's a 30s movie. I don't know, maybe another spice. Yeah, like, what, maybe pepper? Yeah, keep talking. Maybe we say it activates it. Holy shit, that's a fucking million-dollar idea right there. Let's load up these gel caps. Maybe Rogan will move them on his podcast. I mean, I know Marin won't do it. He's more of a Stamps.com Squarespace guy. But Rogan's sort of an old school supplement slinger. And I know I'm going to get a little flack for that comment. I know there might be a minor pile-on on Twitter of the monoculture of free thinkers, but I can take it. So I guess after all is said and done, I should just say that, like, I'm taking turmeric, and I feel less inflamed, you know, in a general way, generally less inflamed. I'm going to believe that. I believe that.
So we are here with Mark Maron. Thank you for joining me.
Yes, my pleasure.
So you said you don't necessarily go into setting an intention when you start developing material for a special, but it does seem like the work of shaping the hour and sharpening the themes comes out right before shooting when you have to winnow the material you developed into what will be included. I think I heard you said you had like an hour and 45 minutes of material going into it. So what was it? What was the story that you landed on that you wanted to tell? What did you decide it needed to be in the hour? And how did you decide this joke fit in that?
Well, I thought that joke sort of was the key to exploring what we believe and what is true and the power of both of those things in the culture that we live in. I mean, it was really a portal into my, see, I have to come from my own place on this stuff. Mm-hmm. So this has got to be my experience. So I've been sort of wrestling with those ideas about, you know, what do I know? What do I not know? Because as the barometers or the precedents or the actual science of truth that we've known in our world becomes sort of tenuous or slippery or shaky, mm-hmm. You know, at some point you have to take stock of who you are around this stuff and really ask yourself, well, how much of what I know is just stuff I hear? How much of what I know is just stuff I react to? What have I really done my homework on? You know, mm-hmm. what did, you know, because I know when I was in college, I don't know that I took anything. And there's a certain amount of bullshit that we all sort of use and charm to get through life and a sort of cramming situation when we have to know things. So it really kind of seemed to me that the turmeric was my way in. And the training, you know, there was a piece that I cut out of that. There's another 5 minutes in there that I do on stage that's not in the special about, you know, going to the doctor. Mm-hmm. The premise being like, don't take medical advice from your trainer. You know, and being prescribed statins and having my trainer tell me that that I shouldn't take statins and having a moment where, you know, I believed her and I was going to tell my doctor that I'm just not going to take the statins because my trainer's uncomfortable with it. And, you know, having my doctor say, your trainer? And then I say, yeah, well, she used to be an actress. So, you know, it was pretty convincing and I kind of want to believe that. But, you know, I cut that for time because, you know, it didn't serve the story necessarily, but it's one of my favorite parts of the joke. So it really became about, you know, health, you know, belief, what we know, what we don't know, you know, what we choose to believe, even if we know it's bullshit, just to get through life. And that was kind of the starting point of the whole special, you know, yeah, around belief and around, you know, reality.
In your previous specials, you have revealed a bit of your process, which involves putting small phrases or words on a post-it note or hotel stationery, which you then from there read on stage. But with this joke, do you remember what was the first spark of it that you're like, there's something here?
You know, some of this stuff I've, you know, kind of worked through out loud on the mics, on the podcast,
yeah.
You know, like a lot of the free thinking around this stuff goes, you know, comes from stream of consciousness on the podcast. But I kind of had two separate things going around the, you know, what do we know? What do we don't know? And then, you know, why is clickbait, you know, effective? You know, why is, you know, everybody reacting? Why, you know, how shallow is anyone's real wisdom or sense of reality? And, but, you know, that was already percolating. But then I talked to some nutritionist that two nutritionists that had, you know, seen me talking about turmeric outside of, or maybe they even responded from hearing me talk about it on the podcast. It just says, they just said, you know, really, your body does not absorb it. It just doesn't. You know, like the amount you would have to take for the body to maybe absorb it is profound.
Yeah.
So a lot of it is, you know, hokum. It's bullshit. So then I kind of realized, well, like, but I still, like, I still take these things. And so there's the vitamin chunk of it.
Yeah.
And I sort of somehow attached the kind of, you know, issues around clickbait. What is, you know, the branch of philosophy of, you know, knowledge? Is it epistemology? What, which one is it? Whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can't be intellectual if I can't drop the fucking word without asking you about it. But you know, that became, they just attached, and they attached nicely. And then as, you know, time went on, exploring the idea of beliefs, which I've done many times before in my stand-up, you know, and bringing Marvel into it, and, you know, and bringing, you know, and then just having the kind of reality that we're up against is the sort of evidence that, you know, anybody can see that, you know, we're in a sort of apocalyptic situation here by virtue of our leader and by virtue of environmental issues.
Yeah.
And then I stack the other stuff on top of that. Those, you know, some of those ideas have been percolating a long time, and they've been out there a long time on the fringes about, you know, the kind of movement of, you know, evangelical Christians supporting Israel primarily to bring on the second coming and, you know, get the sort of prophecy to happen, you know, by making events, you know, by creating a good environment for the events to happen in the prophecy, that, you know, some of them, and they, you know, it's old timey shit and it's been out there a while, but I've sort of, you know, I've integrated that stuff into my stand up before, but this was, it all seemed to kind of land together on this.
It feels like the right time for this. It's like you've been talking about this forever, and now it's like everyone's like on your level.
I just don't know if I've been talking about it clearly. I mean, certainly during the Bush years, you know, there was elements of me, you know, talking in my stand-up about evangelical Christianity, about radical Christianity, about their incentive and their goal. But yeah, the thinking sort of evolved, which is really what I do with the stand-up anyways. To me, it's really an ongoing conversation that I'm having with myself and with the audience, and, you know, sort of as my own brain kind of processes this stuff and kind of understands it deeper or in a different way, you know, the conversation changes. So you know, this is where we're at now. And I think that I found a tone more than anything else. And like, look, you know, I recorded this in October. You know, I mean, the release of it is cosmically appropriate, but, you know, I couldn't have planned that. And certainly I'm not necessarily happy that we're, you know, living in a time of plague, but, you know, it didn't hurt my special, that's for sure.
So I want to go through certain parts of the joke. You can tell me how that evolved or what are you thinking about it. But, so in the sort of I don't know anything section, I think it's really interesting how you go specifically of the, you go, do I even exist, which is sort of sophomoric, to a joke about you and your cat. Are you trying, especially in that section, to like, I need to lighten this up in ways impossible? Do you feel an audience being like, okay, what are we getting in here? This is heavy on heavy. This is...
The thing is, I don't know if it's heavy. I think it's heady.
Yes, I think it's
abstract. You know, these are you know, really sort of, you know, ancient philosophical questions.
Yeah.
And I think that it's a little more relevant because of the amount of information we, you know, allow ourselves to be assaulted by, you know, just by what we're holding in our hand, by our phone. So it really becomes a more pressing kind of question, you know, because of how much we react and respond and adapt and sort of are completely symbiotic with the information spewing devices that we are sitting in front of constantly, and then kind of becoming a repository for that shit and spreading it. You know, it really becomes a fairly relevant question. You know, what do I know? How do I know it? Who am I? Who am I is very important, especially in the face of potential authoritarianism or fascism. It's like, how fortified are you mentally and spiritually and in your own fucking skin to know that you won't buckle? Or, you know, how willing are you to fight? How much have you given up already of your fight and who you are and what you think is important? I mean, these are relevant questions, you know, given the political climate we're in and also the informational media climate we're in. So, like, how do you make those accessible? That was really the question. And the thing about Monkey is that, you know, that kind of, you know, really sophomoric philosophical kind of exploration of do I exist or what is real, which I don't really play with. You know, I'm not going to fuck with that.
Yeah.
You know, like, is this real? Yeah, it's real. I'm sitting in a chair and I'm drinking a tea, but is it? Yes. So really, the reason I threw Monkey in there was that, you know, yeah, it's cute, but it also indicates that, you know, I'm not fucking around with this. This isn't some kind of dumb philosophical exploration. Mm-hmm. This is relevant to what we're living through. So I think I threw that in, if I'm, you know, going to backload this and, kind of be critical of my own work, to sort of, like, you know, show that on a poetic level that, you know, I'm not playing games here like that. Like, that's my cat. He's there. He sees me. I see him. I'm
here.
This
is real. This is real life.
Yeah, but it's a nice beat to it, but it also posits the what I'm trying to talk about is being relevant.
Yeah, and so in the vitamins section, you did a condensed version of this joke on Fallon a few months before you record the special.
Yeah.
And there's two interesting differences I'll bring up, and maybe we can talk about that. Which is in the special, you say I'm afraid to die, and I think this is going to give me a leg up about why you take vitamins. But on Fallon, you say I'm afraid to die and I'm stupid. The other big difference is you go back home to take vitamins, you go, am I going to get into a car accident? Vitamin D stops car accident. Why those two changes, especially the not calling yourself stupid, what do you think that does to the joke, or not have that, what does it do for the joke?
I don't know. I don't know if I was conscious of that. And these things get done differently all the time. But obviously I dropped the stupid thing. That's just an evolution, you know, in terms of naturally trying to get over, you know, if I call myself stupid and everyone takes vitamins stupid, I don't think I'm going to lose the crowd, but it's not necessary because it's not really that true. I mean, really, the deeper thing is about, like, I know these don't do anything, but I still believe in them. And, you know, somehow I'm finding comfort from these. And the vitamin D thing, that's just a joke. And the joke's okay. But I guess I liked, you know, this might be the day I'm going to get whatever I'm going to get. You know what I mean? I thought the subtlety of that was better, and it didn't stop the joke. You know, because I think that the vitamin D thing, you know, and also, you know, on Fallon, you're dealing with a condensed version. You've only got whatever time is allotted you. But the vitamin D thing is really an extension or a play on the, you know, I'm stupid thing.
Yeah. The turmeric section has the long back and forth. Is that a thing where you're just playing with it and whatever the audience says is how long you can keep on going? You're doing the sort of two-man routine of one person.
Oh, yeah, me and the trainer. Oh, yeah. I mean, like, that's a fun thing that, like, I don't think at another point in my career that I would have had the sort of groundedness or the confidence to do, to sort of, like, there was a period, you know, usually in my mind, you know, there's been things I wanted to achieve comedically that, you know, I was aware that I couldn't do it, you know, at a different time where I was, you know, either more afraid or more angry or more intense or desperate, where I didn't have the freedom of mind or craft to sort of engage in these kind of devices that were just fun and just funny because of the repetition and because of the sort of escalation of that, you know, that type of banter. And, you know, as I've gotten older and better and more grounded, I like to engage some of those kind of age old tools or methods of being funny. And that was just one of them. Yeah, sure. It does. You know, it could go on for as long as it's funny and you can feel that. And it's kind of a fun thing to do.
It's funny because as you say that, it's similar to the part of the joke to jump forward where it's the 1930s sort of lackey back and forth, which feels really silly and goofy for you. Do you enjoy this now? This part of you that you said you never really felt like you were comfortable enough to do on stage or you weren't grounded enough. Having these in it, what does it feel like to have that part, which is so silly, of this two-man scene of these sort of 1930s vitamin bosses?
Yeah, I don't know where that came from. It just, like, it came out of my mouth on stage once, the other guy talking, like, I don't know, boss, or whatever that was. And then I realized that, like, you know, this is kind of a thing. And I just ended up saying it. Now, I don't know why it's a 30s movie or whatever I said. But it's funny, after that joke, I was like, does somebody else do that? And I'm thinking, like, does Mulaney do a thing like that? And then I realized, no, Mulaney just talks like that. So, you know, like,
he,
you know,
he
just
constantly is doing that.
Yeah, exactly. But I, you know, I don't know. Like, that's always the bigger fear, too, is that, you know, if these things are sort of tried and true, you know, how much have they been done? And is it the content or the style or what? But it's also, for me, like, at some point, I want to have fun with this. And there's a broad range of engagement around stand-up styles. And I think I'm confident enough in my voice as the underpinning of all this, that I can explore this stuff a little more. And it is funner, you know, more fun for me. And I don't think I really knew how to have fun up there for many years. And also, like, you know, I want to integrate my creativity and whatever my output is into a sort of, you know, into the sort of deep history of stand-up. Like, I really can cite all of my influences and my growth in this special. Like, I can see my kind of, you know, quiet homages, and some of them, you know, really quite conscious to, you know, my comedy heroes in this special. Like, I know where they are. Like, I know where I'm, like, tipping the hat to people and where I'm integrating myself into the kind of history of modern comedy.
Is there something in this joke in particular that you can think of, something either specific or general, that you feel like it taps into?
Well, I think those two things you're talking about are really kind of just, you know, classic kind of, you know, Abbott and Costello teamwork kind of things. I mean, that kind of groove, you know, and Lenny did it a lot. I mean, Lenny Bruce did a lot of movie kind of stuff, did a lot of, you know, what they, you know, somebody I once called, maybe it was Nat Hentoff in a review of somebody, maybe Lenny Bruce said, peopling the stage. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't do, you know, impressions. I can, but I've never really done them for very long on stage. But creating two characters or three characters within a bit was a fairly popular thing in long form comedy. You don't see many cats doing that now. There's a couple of people I know who do it. Obviously, Maria Bamford has a, you know, a deep well of voices and characters. And, you know, I think Al Madrigal in some of his long form bits does, you know, some of that. It's really a beautiful thing to be able to do. And I think that I was sort of honoring, you know, attempting to do that, but sort of honoring the kind of, like, old school kind of, you know, teams or creating a foil within, you know, your own voice that, you know, that goes back to, like, God knows, the 30s, for Christ's sake, you know?
Yeah. The era in which this lackey existed in. So the trainer and yoga stuff, you explained that it was a little bit longer previously. But what I think is interesting is, you know, you are sensitive and thoughtful about broadly the subjects and the targets of your jokes. And even later in the special, you note that you don't feel like you're punching down to evangelicals because there's so many of them compared to how many Jews there are. But it's clear you want in the special to have moments that are provocative or a little bit more abrasive than, like, maybe your last couple specials. You know,
it's definitely hearkening back to a younger me on some level, but I was fairly careful about it.
So for a joke like for with the trainers and a yoga instructor example, we talk about how you worked that part to make sure you were being okay enough that people didn't feel like you're being harsh on yoga instructors or trainers.
I think what it really comes down to with that, whether it's harsh or not, I don't think that what I'm saying is untrue. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of whatever people call provocative or taking chances comedically, sometimes it's really as simple as stating a truth that people are too polite or honestly, maybe it's not necessary to state that.
Yeah.
So I never quite understood why people kind of clam up or drop out when I'm condescending to the trainer, but they do. And, you know, and so for me to go, like, I don't want to burst anyone's bubble, but, you know, it wasn't their first choice, you know, like, I mean, that's, but the truth is, I think there's something about how everybody is just trying to adapt and survive.
Yeah.
So, like, you know, how condescending am I going to be? But I kind of create this character around the trainer of, like, you know, no matter what happens, they're going to be all right.
Yeah.
One way or the other, I don't know about yoga instructors, and I just think there's a vulnerability to them that I was fairly careful around and fairly respectful while I was kind of taking the piss out of them.
Yeah.
And I think there's a truth to it, and I think, you know, this I think one of the reasons the special is playing well at this particular point in time is that I think the honesty of it is relieving. And, you know, and it's not an honesty that kind of reaffirms old stereotypes that are, you know, either, you know, sexist or racist or whatever, but they're fairly specific. They're relatively harmless in mm-hmm. in the power of their truths, but they are powerful because they are true. And, you know, they're funny, but they're not sort of fighting for any sort of, you know, kind of stereotypical territory. Yeah. You know, that we're maintaining out of fear or a need to stay committed to past models that are now outdated or wrong-minded.
I think it also helps. You come from the position of uncertainty. You're not a stand-up that's like, I am the person who knows everything, and I'm going to tell you this is how it is. This special, and even this joke, it starts off being like, I don't know anything. I don't know what I know, which frames everything as, oh, this is a person who is like trying to just grab straws in the same way sort of anyone else is.
Yeah, I think that's a reasonable place to be.
So the Joe Rogan part, was it, you know, useful for you to, as you're being somewhat conspiratorial and thinking or uncertain, to sort of draw a contrast of your version of conspiratorial thinking and anxiousness and the sort of Roganite version?
Well, I mean, that joke was really, you know, first of all, it was kind of like to, you know, kind of play off on the fact about the matter is, in terms of models of what we do, and we're in the same business, both as comics and podcasters. And he's, you know, kind of blown up into this huge empire of what he does. And, you know, I still keep it pretty small and only audio. And but, you know, the idea was, you know, it played into old school supplement slinger. Kind of plays into the hustler element, mm-hmm. but also it plays into a sort of kind of age old presenter, you know, huckster that's always been part of American radio and media and mm-hmm. sales. And, you know, it's fundamentally American, the snake oil salesman. So,
yeah.
You know, so I wanted to hit on that. And I think it was a reasonable and not below the belt kind of dig, you know, because I also said, you know, Marin won't do it. He's more of a Squarespace stamps.com guy. Mm-hmm. So like I'm a selective corporate sellout, whereas he's a, you know, snake oil salesman. And I, you know, and I'm okay with that. I think he could be okay with that. And then, you know, really it wasn't about conspiratorial thinking. Mm-hmm. It's really in terms of my criticism of, you know, saying the monoculture of free thinkers, it's yeah. really that, like, look, the one thing I know about myself is that I've never been a follower and I've never been a leader.
Yeah.
And I'm okay with that. So to have a mass of people that numbers in the hundreds of thousands who claim to be free thinking, yet they're all thinking roughly the same thing, is kind of hilarious.
Yeah.
So, you know, and I've added to that joke here and there. You know, it's like, you know, we're all thinking outside the same box, into the same box, you know. So, you know, so it's I think it's really, you know, it's not bitter. It's not unreasonable. It, you know, I've run into issues where, you know, I talk about people who are my peers or in the same business of me where they take personal offense to this stuff. Years ago, it happened with Adam Sandler. But at some point when even if somebody, you know, reaches a level where they have, you know, true cultural impact, you know, you have to be able, if you are a cultural critic, to criticize, you know, their impact. And, you know, but you run a risk. I understand that. It's a different time than when I insulted Sandler, and him and I are okay, I think. You know, but that was before the internet, I might have even been. But, you know, I did a bit of that, referenced him on Conan, and he took personal affront to it. And, it, you know, it was like, you know, he came up to me and said, I heard you're talking about me. I'm like, yeah, I did it on television. So like, you know, but
it's the same idea of these people are so much bigger. They're living their lives, but they have to understand that they represent so much to the consciousness in general. The idea of Joe Rogan is so much bigger than Joe Rogan.
Right. But I don't know that, you know, you'd think that, but they don't always know that. Yeah. And I don't know if I would either. And, you know, he hasn't said anything. Maybe he's, you know, taking the high road or hasn't heard about it or doesn't want to draw attention to the special or just thinks, you know, I'm a nobody, whatever. I don't care. But, you know, I had to weigh that shit out, you know, in terms of, you know, what are the possibilities of this? Because, you know, it's a bad few days when you're annihilated online by a bunch of meatheads, you know. So, you know, I said, like, all right, well, you know, I think this is funny. I think it's relevant. I think, you know, I can handle it. I think he can handle it. And, you know, and that's that, you know.
Yeah. And so the joke ends where you say you are taking turmeric.
Yeah. Of course it does.
Of course it does. It has to end, and it's you know, it brings it back.
At the time I wrote it, I was still taking it.
So more broadly, so this was the second special in a row you had directed by Lynn Shelton. These are also the only two specials she has directed, and nothing against your other ones, but I do think there's a clear difference, especially with this one, which felt like together you're approaching the special as a filmed piece opposed to, say, a film representation of a live performance. Can you talk about what it means to think about you have this material and to be like, we're creating a visual story as well as capturing the material you've been doing for 2 years?
You mean my relationship with Lynn creatively?
Yeah, just the idea of it being a
Lynn
visual
Shelton,
story.
Well, Lynn Shelton has been a friend of mine for years, and we are now actually dating. Mm-hmm. But back when I first met her, you know, and enjoyed the sort of intimacy of her movies, and then I was able to coincidentally work with her as a director. And she's very intuitive and a huge fan of mine, obviously. And she understands me emotionally, you know, obviously. And she's, understands and loves my comedy for specific reasons. And I think that, you know, working with her, even on the last special she did with Too Real, which was shot in a larger theater,
yeah.
You know, I really, the one thing I said to her is I said, look, you can't, and I don't know if I was among the first to do this or not, but I said, do not go to the audience at all. They that's an old trick that's been used in specials for years, primarily to make cuts. I don't need, you know, four people who I don't know taking up screen time with laughter that, you know, might even be out of context and is mm-hmm. just there so we can remove a chunk of material. So it was really the first note for me was, you know, don't go to the audience, stay on me, and let's try to make this an experience as intimate as what I do, you know, because I, you know, over years of trying to be, it started with deciding to kind of man the stool was to make any size space intimate, yeah. You know, draw people in a way that I can, you know, speak in that tone. I'll get up when I need to. So we did what we could do on that to reel, and I think it worked. You know, we really kind of, the main thing was a shot at the top where a guy came out from the side of the stage on stage to shoot that opening a bit, or right when I come out on stage on Too Real to sort of ground it in an intimacy. And then we stayed off the audience almost entirely, I think. And she, you know, created a crane shot that she could get in as close as possible. So doing, you know, kind of building on that, that idea, you know, we ended up by coincidence or by kismet or by, you know, default at the Red Cat Theater here in LA, which only seats a couple hundred people, and it's a fairly standard black box theater. So it is by nature, you know, almost too intimate in a way.
Yeah.
And a space like that has a certain type of built-in vibe to it, an expectation. You know, people go to those type of spaces to listen, you know, and to engage in, mm-hmm. in theater that is, you know, experimental or staged in a certain way. There's definitely a kind of loftier vibe than one of those kind of old late 1800s, early 1900s vaudeville houses that we usually do specials at, you know. So here I am, you know, kind of, you know, we built this amazing set in this very sort of sparse theatrical space, but it had enough references to stand up, had that the sort of faux wooden floor in my mm-hmm. stool, and we were able to do everything we wanted because we could put cameras anywhere and they were and everything was very close. It's not that big a place.
Yeah.
But I did run into some trouble because, you know, I'm doing two shows. I only get two shows to get this fucking special, man. And the first one was a little like, you know, it was 7 o'clock on a Friday night. It was a 200 people and change, 240 maybe, whatever it was. And, you know, they weren't, they were listening, but they weren't giving back enough for me to move through it the way I wanted to.
How much laughing do you feel like your comedy needs to feel like, you know, like obviously you want laughs, but
dude, I'm yeah. like, I'm an old school fucking yeah. comic. I know how to do a comedy club.
Yeah.
I know how to do theaters. I'm not some like, you know, I didn't come out of some alternative universe. I came up in comedy clubs. I do the job.
Yeah.
So I know where laughs need to be and sure. I know where they need to be big, you know, so. You know, so the fact is, you know, it wasn't their fault. It just, it was too early. They still light out. It was Friday. You know, I don't know what the story was. I wasn't mad at them. I knew what was going on. It wasn't because I sucked. It, was, mm-hmm. it wasn't because they sucked. It just was what it was. And that's when I realized, like, the liability of that type of space. When you're in a space that doesn't inherently have its own personality other than this is a black box theater where experimental theater happens, you know, people go in with a kind of, it's got a weird zap on the head, you know? So second show, like everything was on the line, you know, and cool. I went out there and I fucking nailed it. And, you know, and I had no choice. and I don't know what the audience felt or why, but, you know, they gave me what I needed. And that was fortuitous. Is that the word? Because
yes.
I didn't have another shot at it, you know?
We'll be right back with more Marc Maron.
Support for this show comes from Art, Beats, and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniels, Tennessee Honey, and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art, Beats, and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual paths while also revealing their distinct roles within Art, Beats, and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Vacations can be tricky. You already know how to book flights and hotels, but now the only thing you're missing is, you know, the actual travel experience. Because is it really a vacation if you're just sitting around like you would at home? You need a tool to get the most out of your time away. That's where Viator steps in. You can book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
You know, you said you were always after becoming a comedian with a point of view and being genuine about that. Do you feel part of it is you've aged into your persona, both for you and for the audience? Like, these things make more sense as a person who's at this part of your life?
I guess so. You know, it's a weird thing about that, about, you know, because, you know, people always, you know, say, like, you know, I'm pretty much the same guy, you know. Like, I think I've always just was trying to become myself and to be okay in that, you know, and to be comfortable with that. And I think that's true. And I think the depth of my emotional struggle in front of people is probably, you know, when you look at some of my other work, is a little uncomfortable. But again, I wasn't setting out to shock or make people uncomfortable. I was really processing stuff, and I thought that if I'm honest about this on stage, I'll find people who relate to it, and then I can, you know, and then we can all feel a little, you know, seen. You know, I think the idea is to be seen for truly who you are, and, you know, a lot of that I did in front of audiences, and that's still the case. So, yeah, I mean, I guess I've grown older and wiser, you know, to some degree, but and more comfortable. But I, you know, I think I was always me, but I just was never, you know, that comedy in and of itself is sort of a defense mechanism or a relief valve. To engage in being funny is kind of a defense mechanism. If you're just a regular person, it does kind of, you know, you keep people out of you.
Yeah.
But, you know, to do it professionally, you know, then it becomes something different, but it's still the root of being funny is that of being funny, is to sort of make things easier for yourself, you know, either by, you know, protecting yourself or disarming situations. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, that's the nature of it. So, you know, to show myself throughout from under that stuff has become, you know, the journey of me, you know, arriving as me on stage. So yeah, I think that's happened, but I don't remember what the original question was.
I think you've answered it. It's about aging into the persona that can talk about
think,
the topic.
Yeah, see, I don't quite agree with that. I think that, because the persona, like, I've had different approaches to this thing, you know, so I don't think I've aged into a persona. I think I've evolved into who I am.
Yeah. I think part of it is also, I want to talk to you about your relationship to the audience. To sort of summarize quickly, in Final Engagement, the album you released in 2009, which was sort of at a low point professionally before the podcast hit, you point out that the yeah. club is half sold. Then in your first special in 2013, Thinky Pain, you talk about how you want in a small room because that's where comedy is done, not in theaters where you're running all over the place. But then obviously fast forward to Real was in this large theater. And now with End Times, not only is it in this small black box, as you said, the audience is sort of blacked out in a way that's like borderline menacing in a way. But through sort of all of that, you know, how has your feeling about the audience changed and your relationship changed over the last, you know, 10 years?
Well, I mean, it's changed in the fact that, like, yeah, I mean, I still believe, because for me, look, man, you know, comedy, you know, when you have the freedom of mind to take chances up there that even you don't know what they are, you know, that's where it happens, okay? Mm-hmm. And that's club comedy for the most part. Though I've taken those chances on bigger stages, and I do always take those chances in all of the specials. Almost all of them, there's stuff in them that I have never done before, ever. Mm-hmm. And I may never do again. So that's how I keep, you know, an hour set or an hour and 10 minute set vital and alive, is that I really enter all of those things knowing that it's all there, but knowing that, but don't be afraid to go. You know, if you feel an opening to go out there on the wire, do it.
Yeah.
You know, so I still believe that. But I think the other thing that's changed is that since I've made some of those original statements, I've built an audience for myself and I have an audience now. I didn't during Thinky Pain for real. I did not have an audience. I could not sell tickets, really. So that changes things for better and for worse. You know, then you have a bunch of people that know you too well, you know, being a podcaster and being in the world we live in now in terms of accessibility. Most of the people that like me and dig me and like my work, they know me pretty fucking well.
Yeah.
But some people come from other avenues, from Glow or from, you know, doing, you know, whatever. But they do know me. But I think that does change things, you know, in that, like, I can sell 800 to 1,000 tickets in some place. Like, yeah, I can sell more than that. For the last couple, you know, in those theaters, which were 900 seaters, 1,100 seaters, I can sell that many tickets and people will come out and they'll enjoy it. And I like that. And I can make those intimate experiences. And I, again, the kind of cosmic timing, the whatever it is, the serendipity, mm-hmm. or the whatever happened that got me into this black box was not planned.
But so, I mean, to that point, are having this fan base that knows you, I mean, you said before that having this fan base allowed you to feel more comfortable to be free on stage?
Well, yeah, oh, certainly, for sure. But the truth is like, look, I go out every week, I'm in town, and I do the Comedy Store, and they're not all there to see me. That's just regular club work. When I'm building a set, you know, I'll go do little clubs across the country, and I've got, maybe they'll be all my people, but certainly if I do a theater, no one's just happening upon that.
Yeah.
No one's walking by a theater going like, oh, let's go, who's this guy? Let's go see it. But, you know, when you do a comedy club of any kind, that's the reality and that's the job. So there, by all means, I keep my chops in order. You know, I go out and I do this. I do the Comedy Store. I'm going out there tomorrow night in the midst of the plague, and I'm gonna fucking work out. You know, as far as I know, until they close it all down.
Yeah.
But you know, that's the work. That's the gymnasium, because by virtue of the fact that all my material is constructed improvisationally on stage in front of people, with me working through ideas and slowly honing that over a period of time, the nature of what I believe is where comedy happens is still where it happens. It's in a smaller room.
And so as we wind down, I want to address the sort of elephant in every room. Can you talk about releasing your special right now that's talking about sort of all these things and is coming out during coronavirus? How has that felt this week as both these things are happening at once?
I don't know, man. It's weird, right? Heading into this, you know, my feeling was like, look, this special will go up and it'll just get kind of, you know, lost in the churning cloud that delivers us all of our shit. You know, like I didn't, you know, I fully anticipated, like, you know, I'd get my people to watch it and, you know, and then, you know, it would just fade. So, you know, my expectations were very different. Obviously, I don't want everyone to get sick, but if you're at home, maybe this is a good thing to watch at this particular point in time. So I'm sort of amazed. It's that weird mixture of excitement and horror. That's my feeling. And I'm happy I can provide the relief necessary for this particular point in history, and that somehow or another, October, November, December, January, February, March. So somehow in 4 months, you know, you got to keep it kind of broad, you know, but I knew that it was broad enough and that most of what I was talking about was going to be our reality for a while. You know, I couldn't have banked on this.
No.
Or that, you know, me saying something horrible, it's going to take something horrible to get people back, you know, together, that, you know, that would read as this, you know. But I do feel that it is a good thing to watch to find a little respite, but also, you know, a little kind of, what's the word I want? A little kind of
relief,
release, but hard comfort in hard truths that, you know, again, you know, reacting to something that, you know, is a truth framed in a different way. You know, comedy can frame things in ways that you may not have understood it before. I mean, that's why I always loved it when I was a kid, is that, you know, a good comic could take things that were daunting or scary or seemingly unapproachable and within a few lines really make it accessible and make you laugh at it and kind of put it into your head in a different place, you know, to change the way you think about something, you know, in a very immediate way. And also you can feel reaffirmed in some ways in your own feelings. And less alone in some way. So all that stuff happens, and you know, this is a good time for it. And I'm sorry it's a horrible time, but I'm happy that the shit is out there so people can be like, okay, that made me feel better and I'm not crazy.
I was talking to my father, who's a psychologist and Jewish, and he was talking about how this feels like the moment neurotic people, hypochondriacal people have been prepared for. And I do think there's a little bit of, like, this special captures, I think, the way a lot of people who were on high alert just as an everyday basis act like. And it's useful for people who are able to compartmentalize a little bit more easily to have a person who's like, this is how I live with this stuff normally.
I mean, that's what my producer, Brendan McDonald, you know, he said that I was more well prepared for what's happening, and and I'm quoting him, he says, I think people with generalized anxiety are in a better position than people who don't have that or only get anxious in spikes. You and your people rehearse catastrophic situations in your head all the time. like you're ready to roll.
Yeah.
That's what he said. So he's like, he's saying like what your dad said. Yeah, I guess that's true. Cause I feel okay right now.
Yeah, me too. You talk about a Jewishness a lot in this show. You know, it's come out different times in your stand-up, especially pre-2009, but it seemed really central to the worldview that you're sharing here. As a person who not only cares about this tradition, but also has talked to a lot of the people who've defined comedy as a Jewish tradition, you know, what does it mean to you to be a Jewish comedian, to fit into the history of Jewish comedy?
For years, I stayed away from it. You know, I was like, I couldn't figure out a way to do it that wasn't, you know, hackneyed or stereotypical. You know, I just didn't like, you know, Jewish comedy always sort of fell into the realm of like, you know, Jews, they like to sit down, you know, like, you know, Jackie yeah. Mason stuff. Like, well, I don't even know what that means, you know, but I do know what it means and I understand it, you know, and also like you can't, there are certain Jewish comics you can't remove, like, you know, for everything that is said or understood or not understood or mythologized about Lenny Bruce, he was a fundamentally Jewish comic.
Yes.
In all aspects, to the point where he spoke Yiddish in a lot of his bits.
Yeah.
But, you know, there is a kind of the history of Jews in dialogue with themselves and with God philosophically and you know, and kind of the premium that the Jewish people have put on education to make sure that we survive in a world where we're going to be denied things or killed, you know, certainly at this particular juncture in history weighs heavy on me. You know, one of the first Jewish jokes I ever really kind of worked out for myself was, you know, in the 95 HBO half hour about, you know, the kind of myth of the conspiracy about, you know, Jews having all the money, mm-hmm. you know, and doing this long bit of like, yep, we have it all, you know, and, you know, we meet sometimes, we go to synagogues, every synagogue has a room in the basement that's just, you know, gold coins and, you know, like, and this is different in that Jewish identity, I think, is again in at stake and in mm-hmm. peril as are Jewish people. So, you know, it's a scary thing. I think I kind of do a throwaway line about that. It's important for Jews to state that they're a Jew, you know, just, you know, out of context to make themselves a target and to make other Jews feel comfortable. You know, I once worked with Paul Mooney and years ago in Sacramento, I featured for Paul Mooney, and Paul Mooney is an African-American comic, and he's, you know, hardcore.
Yeah.
And
he used to write a lot for Richard Pryor. He wrote sure. that just for context for listeners.
And he's also a comic. He co-wrote yeah. JoJo Dancer. He, you yeah. know, he was, you know, a confidant of Pryor's, and he wrote a lot with Richard Pryor. So
he was on Chappelle's show.
I don't know if he's well or not, but years ago, I worked with him in Sacramento. You know, it was a primarily white audience, and, you know, and Mooney's just doing his Mooney thing, which is really, you know, he'll do at least 2 hours, you know, and everything is basically, you know, indicting whites and using the N-word constantly. And, you know, it's righteous shit. It's you know, it's persistent. And I didn't, you know, realize until, you know, maybe a month or so later what he was doing. But the thing is that no matter who you think you are or how progressive you think you are, whatever you're made of, like what he's doing when you're a white person sitting in that audience is that he's defying you by persistence and just sheer, you know, the longevity of the set and mm-hmm. through repetition. He's defying you to, you know, to fight the part of yourself that says, you know, when's this black guy going to shut up? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
when's
yeah.
When is this N-word going to shut up about this? We get it. You know, we get it. You're black. So he is searching for you to experience your own racism.
Yeah.
Right? So in honor of that, which is one of the homages mm-hmm. in this special, that I push that Jewishing in a tone that's vulnerable and kind of like, you know, like Jews are just amazing. I'm defying people. I want people to have that experience in themselves. And I don't remember, is that line in the special, like most people are anti-Semitic?
Yes.
See, like that's an old joke of mine.
What's the exact joke again?
That, you know, I'm not saying they're walking around saying I hate the Jews, but it doesn't take much baiting.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So So that's really why I do it. You know, it's definitely, you know, it's like, you know, the Jews are here and, you know, and we're vulnerable, but you know, we're not going to go down without a fight. And you need to know whether or not you're anti-Semitic.
Yeah.
Find it. So, you know, that's really what's going on there outside of the fundamental Jewish nature of who I am.
Exactly. To go back to a little bit to coronavirus, you've talked about how you got into comedy to figure out who you were. As you write in your book, you wanted to finish the construction of yourself. So you've been doing this for about 35 years or so. You know, what does it mean to you and the construction of yourself to help people, to have comedy that is useful for people? And especially at this time, you know, where we don't know if people are going to be going to comedy clubs for the next weeks or months.
Look, you know, this is all like a happy accident in a way. You know, I obviously, you know, with the podcast and with the nature of where that comes from, that the fundamental source of the podcast is an idea that I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, which is that when two people get together and talk, they get out of themselves and into somebody else's story. Mm-hmm. And that there's no way that doesn't help both people. So that's the premise of that. So, you know, with the comedy and with the podcast and with, you know, any of the, you know, obviously I have more freedom of mind I don't have to be funny on the podcast. You know, as a stand-up, it's your job.
Yeah.
So between both things, the fact that people, you know, get something out of my willingness to share my struggles and my vulnerability and whatever it is that I'm feeling, you know, that they, you know, they feel a little, you know, less lonely or a little more relieved. I mean, this is an isolating time, and coronavirus not going to help anything. I mean, I talked to Brendan about this, that, you know, if we survive as a species, when they look back on this period of history, the thing that's really going to stand out, his point was that how isolated everyone was.
Mm-hmm.
And that, like, most of the thinking and bile and everything else happens in this strange vacuum of people's individual lives. And some of those lives are tragic and horrible and compromised and unfair. But they have this outlet to engage with the world through, you know, social media and everything else. But it's a lot of it is coming out of complete lack of connection with other people or with community. So the fact that, you know, this stuff that I'm doing is bringing, I think, a fairly, you know, sensitive and vulnerable bunch feel a little seen and a little less alone and a little better and a little publicly represented. And then there are other people on top of them who are a little more together, who can just, you know, get a kick out of some of the stuff I do. And then there are people that are just like, well, this guy's just a baby. And, you know, all right, you know, you project whatever you want to project.
Yeah.
So, you know, yeah, I feel good that it's happening. I'm not great at taking compliments. I kind of just, you know, keep moving. And you know, but I'm grateful that I've been afforded the opportunities I have at this point in my life, and that they are making a difference, you know, to some people's lives.
Does it affirm this? I mean, like, in so much as having people respond to it, to get back to sort of a lot of the questions of, like, audience and the figuring out who you are, having an audience and having it be meaningful, is it affirming, or ultimately you're doing you and it is meaningful but not necessarily driving?
Of course it's affirming. It's like, it's one of the reasons that you know, I've been able to have a sense of comfort within my own skin, to have any sort of peace of mind or to think that, you know, my life's work is worth something. I mean, mm-hmm. I started doing comedy primarily because I wanted to, you know, I had something to say. I didn't know what it was, but I knew this is where I wanted to say it.
Yeah.
And you know, as time went on, you know, that something is kind of evolved into something that is valid.
Yeah.
So, you know, after all these years, you know, of the podcast becoming popular and having this kind of feedback and, you know, being sober and then having the comedy reflect like this, is that I know that I didn't squander my life, that, you know, that I had a higher calling, which was comedy, and that I don't know how people look at it, but that's how I look at it, and that, you know, I honored it, and it suited, you know, and grew with me, and was able to sort of deliver whatever the fuck it is I'm a vessel for delivering.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, it definitely is not lost on me, and I definitely feel good about that.
Well, you know, in your pre 2009, you'll talk about a lack of success or your bitterness towards a lack of success, or not necessarily latching on, you know, thinking about now where you found a sort of stability, you know, what did you expect success to look like? And now that you sort of have it, how has your idea of success as a comedic artist, as whatever, evolved?
Well, you know, I don't, it's hard for me to tell. Like, I, you know, it's like, I don't, in the sense that, like, I know, like, on a fundamental level, you know, living the life I've lived most of my life, you know, the one thing that is comforting is, you know, unless, you know, everything falls apart, you know, I don't have to freak out about money right mm-hmm. now, which is a load off.
Yeah.
I also know that creatively, I have a lot of freedom of mind, and that I have places I can go to express myself. That's great. You know, I can do that anytime. That's nice. I like my house. I'm trying to learn how to enjoy things, and you know, the timing on that's not great given the world we're living in.
Mm-hmm.
But how does it affect my life? I still find a way to think I'm not doing the best I can, and that, like, I wish more people liked me. There's still part of me that thinks, like, so that's why is that guy so popular? Because, like, yeah. You know, in the big picture of things, I'm still an acquired taste. I'm still kind of a marginal figure. I do all right for myself. I make a nice living, you know, but I'm not huge. But I think there's probably a reason for that. Like, there's a reason for everything else. I'm not being spiritual here. I'm not being God. God-minded, maybe I am. I don't know. I don't know who I would be if I got that big. I imagine I would, you know, I would crush myself under the expectations of that responsibility. So I think I'm exactly where I need to be. I always think that I'm going to dry up, or I'm, you know, I'm going to repeat myself, or that, you know, I'm going to, I talk about, like, you know, going off the grid or quitting comedy or, you know, fuck everything. You know, I have those days, you know, almost mm-hmm. every day for an hour. So, you know, I still fight that fight. Is it necessary? I don't know, but I guess it's who I am.
But it seems like you would prefer to be an acquired taste than the alternative, which is a sort of like, well, everyone gets in the meeting.
Yeah, but you know, you can't make that happen. I'm never going to be that guy. There's nothing I could do to make that happen. And you know, some of the guys I like or have respected in my life were, you know, are fucking huge. But I find a little space in my heart to be jealous of that. But I know in my heart also that I am not cut out for that, man. And you know, I can't do it any differently than I'm doing it. So that's who I am, and that's okay.
I was watching your Evening at the Improv set from 1991, which is available on Amazon, I believe, and I think I've heard you've rewatched it. Just to summarize, there's jokes I was thinking about. There's a joke about you having APC, which is AIDS paranoia complex, or there's the joke where you sit down to recreate passengers on a flight that crash that go on to catch their connecting flights. You know, that's nearly 30 years ago. When you think about those jokes and that guy, do you see the same comedian? Do you see a different comedian?
It's weird when I watch those, like, because I always assume that, like, you know, like, I'm so different. But no, I see it's me, man. Don't you see me?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm younger, but the voice is the same. That, you know, the kind of the way of thinking is the same. Like I always assume that, like, I didn't know who I was, or, like, you know, like, I've got to become this or that, but I'm that guy. You know, I'm older and I'm better at what I do, and I'm, you know, I'm wiser, and I'm a little more filled out, but I used to not be able to hear myself in that guy, but I completely hear myself in that guy.
Yeah, there's something really beautiful when because I watched it before I watched End Times Again, and I was like, yeah, it's all about, like, it's this guy who's, it's literally about being paranoid about, like, drugs and the end of society or existence. And it's like, that person was imagining hypothetically being the comedian maybe are now. But I thought there was really something really charming about that.
About what? That the arc is that, you know, you can see me there?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, me too. I mean, I don't know if I find it charming, but I'm relieved, and yeah. I feel like I was probably too hard on myself for the last 30 years because, you know, I just assumed that for some reason, I don't know why, that, you know, that I was had some sort of nebulous self, that mm-hmm. I was not fully formed. But the you know, because of my parents' selfishness and, you know, my poor self-parenting techniques that I engaged very early on. But like when I watch that, I'm like, oh, fuck, I was always me. What the fuck was I doing to myself, you know?
In general, looking back that, or now, do you think about, I've heard you talk about it as difference between music and comedy, but does comedy as it ages, do you think about like, oh, I want my comedy to make sense in 30 years? Or do you ultimately feel like, oh, it's a temporary thing and that's sort of what's special about it?
No, I think that's a liability of comedy in general. I mean, there's nothing you can do about that, that for some reason, a lot of it speaks to the age it was created. You know, that's why, you know, so many people don't know the thousands of comics that have come before us, you know, because it doesn't really hold up. It's a rare type of person that holds up. You know, like in my mind, I can only think of a couple. There are some, you know, basic clowns who are great comics that do physical comedy. That's not really, sometimes the technology of what they're goofing on, you know, fades away. But I think the greatest example of a sort of timelessness of a kind of a Neil Young of comedy, you know, in terms of like how his old records seem to hold up and aren't, you know, not the middle period, but the original ones kind of like.
Yeah, of course.
They're, you know, but like I think Hedberg is like one of the only guys that, you know, can always, you know, pick up a few people, you know, like like you listen to the Hedberg. Right,
yeah,
the Hedberg records. If you're a kid or you're 15 and someone gives you a Hedberg record today, it's going to be just as good as it was when he first came out, you know, for that person.
Yeah, and that makes sense. And I think what you, in exchange, you get something sort of what's happening now with End Times Fun, which is this week or this month, when people look back at it, you had a special that sort of captured it exactly while it was happening.
Yeah, I think most of my stuff is of its time. I think some of the personal stuff will hold up, you know, mm-hmm. for a while, and there's a lot of that on the last two specials. You know, I think that stuff is kind of timeless. But, you know, obviously stuff where you're, like, where I made the choice, I was like, all right, you know, what's my time window here? You know, and I think that's a reason why a lot of comics don't do topical shit on specials is, you know, you've got this lag between doing it and when it's going to be up. But I felt that this stuff would hold, but I had no idea it would be as on the nose as it is because of the tragic events of today.
So that sound means it's time for our final segment, which is the laughing round. It's like a lightning round, but because it's comedy, it's laughing.
Okay.
I've been dreading for years having to say that in front of you.
I just hope I can do it. I'm on the spot. I feel like, what are you going to? All right.
They're easy and you can always pass. Do you have a favorite joke, street joke, or any joke that comes to mind that is jokey joke?
There's a couple old Jewish jokes that I always liked. And there was one that my buddy Dan Vitale used to do. It's not really a street joke, but he's another comic. Yeah. And I always loved the joke where he's, you know, talking about, he's a guy that, you know, he was about to happen, man. They got cast on Saturday Night Live, but his demons got the best of him, drinking, drugs, everything else. He's sober now, but I interviewed him years ago, but he's doing this joke about, I'm paraphrasing, but it's like, you know, you hear about people hitting bottom, you hear about that, folks, but, you know, I got to tell you, man, I was, I was laying in the street, drunk, you know, talking to myself. I had a bottle of vodka in one hand, a crack pipe in the other hand, you know, and I was broke. And I'm telling you, that was the bottom, you know what I mean? I definitely hit bottom. And then he says, but you know, when you hit bottom, you'd be surprised at how much give that floor has.
Do you have a joke you wish you can steal, or just sort of joke another comedian told that when you saw, you're like, damn, I wish I thought that, or, you know, I wish I could have had that in my act. No one would, you know, it's a different universe. So this is everything exactly the same, but you have this one joke or idea.
No, I mean, you know, there are jokes that I liked, you know, and there was a period there where, you know, you kind of go like, well, what's everyone else's take on this? Generally, my envy used to fall around people who, you know, who had the freedom and the sort of innate ability without even trying to be incredibly physically funny.
Yeah.
Or, you know, do voices and things. Like, you know, a lot of my favorite comics to watch, like Al Madrigal or Maria or, you know, even Kevin James, you know, just sort of like, you know, they just can't help. Either, you know, they just have a freedom of storytelling and doing characters, or they just can't help but be physically funny. You know, I've sort of wished that I could execute like other people. But like, you know, sure, there are jokes that I'm like, God damn it. But I don't do that so much, mm-hmm. you know, that I recall that like, you know, more what happens is like, oh, that's too close to my joke.
Yeah.
You know, and like, who did it first? Are we working together? But eventually I learned that, like, you know, just get rid of it. Drop the joke. There's another joke that I really liked.
Sure.
And it's a Bill Hicks joke. Hicks used to do this joke about, yeah, I've been dating this woman for a year and a half. I guess it's time to, you know, pop the big question. Why are we still going out?
That's good. I have some quick WTF questions. We have talked only about stand-up, and I, as a person who also interviews comedians, I was wondering, are people that you wish you could interview again? Like, who would be people that, if you could, you know, next week interview them again, that are on the
list?
Yeah,
I mean, we've talked about that. I mean, there's definitely, you know, like, there's people that, you know, have either been through shit or people that have gotten incredibly, massively successful since we talked to them, you know. Kevin Hart comes to mind, even Amy Schumer, what she's gone through. I mean, there are certain people that have become like huge and gone up and down and up and down. Like, so, you know, we could look at that, you know, in terms of people who have gone through shit. I doubt that, you know, Louis would ever talk to me again, but, you know, seeing where he's at, but I don't know where that is exactly. But, you know, but you just those people that have either gone through things or become, you know, beyond anything we could have imagined since I've talked to them, might be good to revisit.
You've talked about how Albert Brooks has become a bit of a white whale for you. Do you
I love him.
Yeah, me too. Do you have a sense of what you'd want to ask him about?
I just like the sort of arc of his career, for one, you know, and what he comes from, you know, his father, his brother, you know, and like how he was so fucking funny to so many people before he even stepped on a stage, and also what he's thinking about now, which I kind of know he's freaking out. You know, but I don't know what it is that, I understand why some people just don't want to talk about themselves for an hour. Yeah. I haven't really, you know, tried too hard to get Larry David, you know, or Jerry Seinfeld, because I don't think he really likes me or understands me, or, you know, even gives a shit. But, you know, Albert, I like, and I feel like I have common, you know, sort of things with him. And, you know, he certainly influenced me a lot in some ways. So, like, the regular stuff.
I do think Jerry would like talking to you. I don't know how he feels about you personally, but I do think he would be like, I don't know how personally he would get, but I do think he would at least like talking about comedy.
Look, he's been offered to it, and people I know have talked to him about it. And he's just said, you know, why would I do that?
Yeah.
And whatever. I don't know if that's changed. But, you know, again, it's like one of those things where I don't think he respects me as a comic. I've never been asked to been on his show. You know, why not? You know, I know there's a lot of comics in the world, but, you know, I would be perfect for that show. I just don't think I'm on his radar, or that he has any knowledge or respect for me as a comedian. That's my belief.
Yeah. So as we wrap up, I want to say thank you, partly because, obviously, the fact that the podcast existed allowed for me to have a podcast where I interview comedians. But beyond that, starting that podcast allowed people to start taking comedy seriously, saying to people, comedians are interesting, their craft is interesting, what they do is completely changed, I think, in my opinion, how this country saw comedians. And I feel like I really need to thank you, because that I have this career and this show and being able to talk to you for this long is because of the sort of vocabulary and conversation you've been able to give to the public. So as we wrap up, I wanted to say thank you and accept as much. I know it's hard to accept compliments, but I feel bad if I didn't say anything.
Well, you're welcome. And what I generally say when people compliment me about anything, my go-to is glad to help out.
That's good. I'm gonna also learn that. So
okay.
your influence continues. That's it for another episode. You can watch End Times Fun on Netflix and, of course, listen to Mark's twice-weekly interview podcast, WTF. Follow Mark on social media, at Mark Maron. Good One is produced by myself, Jelani Carter, and Art Chung. Editorial assistance from Amanda Gordon. Gautam Srikishan did our theme song. Write a review and rate the show on Apple Podcasts. 5 stars, please. Email any comments, questions, or laughing around suggestions to goodonepodcast@gmail.com or tweet at us, at goodonepodcast. I'm Jesse David Fox, and you can follow me at Jesse David Fox. Good One is a production of Vulture and the Vox Media Podcast Network. We'll be back next week with Ronnie Chang. Have a good one.
Support for this show comes from Art, Beats, and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniels, Tennessee Honey, and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art, Beats, and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual paths while also revealing their distinct roles within art, beats, and lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Why do you run? Why does anyone?
I always thought that runners loved running, and that's not the case. Most runners hate running, but they choose to do it.
In the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Teen Milk, Abby Ayers learns why women runners everywhere are driven to go the distance.
It really is about taking my power back and proving myself wrong.
Teen Milk is about fueling women's performance and helping them along their marathon journeys. You can sign up now for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon taking place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16th, 2024. Learn more and register at everywomansmarathon.com.